Hey, how's it going out there?
Welcome.
My name is Joe.
And I'm Carolyn.
You're in fact listening to the one and only Carolyn and Joe show. I guess it's Tuesday. I don't even know what day it is really today in which we're recording this.
It doesn't matter as long as you're listening and you are listening.
That's right. You.
And this is, do you believe this? I haven't been counting or anything, but I believe this is episode 199.
199?
Of the Carolyn and Joe show. Amazing.
I'm counting and I'm pretty excited. I don't even know what we're going to do for episode 200. But you know what? I think we have a good warm-up guest for that episode.
Definitely.
200 for 199. We have never had this guy on the show ever.
But we know him, and we didn't just pick him up off the street. This is a guy that's been around touring comic conventions, been around town, been all across at least the East Coast, maybe even further, because I know you went to some other far-out events, like in Portland, right?
That is true.
Okay, and this right here in studio is Rafer Roberts.
How's it going, Rafer?
It's going good. Hi, so, everybody.
Hey.
So where have you been on tour? I know you've been all around. You do a massive tour just like Curl Studio does.
You want a complete list?
Yes.
All right. In 2012, I was at Stumptown. I've done Emerald City Comic Con before. Stumptown's in Portland, Oregon. I've done Pittsburgh Comic Con, Small Press Expo, Baltimore Comic Con, Heroes, Fanaticon was down in Asheville, but have that anymore. Asbury Park Comic Con,
yeah.
I think I saw you there. New York Comic Con. I can't even remember.
You're a man about town.
A man about the world. About
many towns.
Yes.
So I have not been to Stumptown or Emerald City or the one that you just said is not around anymore.
Stumptown is a fantastic show. It's
like the SPX of Portland, right?
Yeah. It's probably not as big as SPX was this past year. I'd say it's like SPX circa 2006, 2007. It's about approximate size-wise there and in terms of feel of the types of crowds you get in and the types of artists that are there. It's fantastic.
So just to get into it, your main book, or even I'd say your flagship book, is Plastic Farm, right?
Is Plastic Farm, yes.
How long has Plastic Farm been around in your life? Like even before you started publishing it, did you have some before?
Yeah, Plastic Farm's been around even before Plastic Farm was around in different forms. Because half the characters appeared in different comic books and comic strips that I'd been making since probably like third or fourth grade, honestly.
So it's been inside you. It's been growing, manifesting inside of you.
Yeah, like a little alien.
Just so that people know what exactly is Plastic Farm
pitch
to
it
you?
To
what
us.
Is yeah? What's right. Plastic Farm to you?
Right. Well, to me or to the pitch that I tell everybody at shows.
Let's hear both of them. What's the difference?
Personally, to me, it's like a freaking Moby Dick is the white whale that's just been gnawing at my soul that I have to hunt down and kill and just finish the thing eventually, because Plastic Farm in its current form has been going on for about 10 years, and I'd like to finish it within the next 10, but it's the official pitch is it's the story of a man named Chester who's slowly losing his mind and how that madness is escaping and reshaping the world in many strange, terrifying, and hilarious ways. And I've said that phrase so many times I didn't even have to think about the words I was saying. It's like a reflex that my vocal cords will just vomit these words out of my mouth. It's fantastic.
And that's usually, like, I guess for people who start making comics or they start making anything, really coming up with just sort of that that quick pitch, the sort of default pitch that happens,
that elevator pitch.
Yeah. Have you had to ask or tell people, like, you know, like even I guess mortals out there, do they ever ask you, look, so what's your book about, like in an elevator? And do you just pitch that, or was there a time where you were nervous about that pitch or what that book was?
Back in the early days, it took a while to really develop that, and I was trying to explain the book by giving too many fine details, like giving a list of the different characters that were in there as well. And it would take, like, by about the fifth or sixth issue, that started taking about 10 minutes just to, it's like War and Peace on acid. Which actually, now that I said that out loud, is much
better.
You're
like, that's my new pitch.
That's
right
the
there.
New pitch.
It's War and Peace on acid. And I almost feel like you have to, at least for us, when we make our books or when we pitch it, we have to like almost pass judgment on the person that we're looking at or who's asking. It's like, I can't tell, a little kid, oh, it's, I guess in your terms, would you tell a little kid, like, oh, it's War and Peace on acid?
No, to the like the aging like the new age people, I usually say it looks like a Celestine Prophecy, but good. That's a good one. And then like to like the college kids, like the younger like college humor crowd, I say it's a deep spiritual philosophical journey with dick and fart jokes.
I've been paying attention to what you're doing on Tumblr, and you sort of have, what was it? Well, like you're trying to do 300 pages, like a year, or like what was it? A page a day, or what was the?
Oh, it was my New Year's resolution for this year. I wanted, as part of killing this white whale,
yeah,
I need to draw faster. I need to draw more and faster. So in order to do that, I started keeping a work log, and pretty much keeping track of what I was doing every day, if it was drawing comics, which was the intent,
yeah,
or what I was doing as opposed to drawing comics. Like if I was watching a movie, I had to write that down, and then I'd feel guilty if I didn't meet my goal. But my goal was 100 pages done within the calendar year.
Okay.
And I actually reached that last week.
Oh, wow. So with 2 months left to spare,
with 2 months left to spare, and with that crazy September, where yeah, there was Baltimore SPX.
Convention every weekend.
Yeah, convention every weekend. Like 6 weekends in a row, I was out of town. So
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Were you able to, I know that Carolyn has trouble or a challenge doing this, but are you able to work like at conventions? Like if you're trying to meet that deadline, are you able to still draw a page or?
Oh, what, in like the hotel room? I can't.
Or like the convention itself.
Or at the actual convention.
No, I have that problem too, because
It's too much distraction.
There's way too much distraction. I'm trying to sell books at the same time, yeah, and I can't do that if I'm face down in a page.
Agreed.
Yeah.
It's weird because that was actually my first experience like at SPX. Is I actually thought that's what we're supposed to do. Like, as creators, we're supposed to be behind the table looking like we're doing something. Like, when I first went to SPX, I saw so many people that just had their
heads down,
looking, I don't know, sad. Or I don't know. It's different. It was a different time.
Well, this year at Heroes, I started trying to take commissions at the table.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit different than trying to draw my actual comic.
Yeah.
And what I found was I didn't get that, you know, like that 3 mile stare where you're just, when nobody's coming by the table for a little while and you're just like staring at everybody, just begging people to come stop, like please stop at my table and buy my comics. If I was sitting there actually drawing something for somebody, then I could just, if somebody came close to the table, I could look up and talk to them, but then continue to drawing a picture of Aquaman or something for them, and which was a lot of fun at that show. At SPX it would be impossible to do that. It was just so crowded.
It's also tight for exhibitors at SPX.
Yes.
Like everything's pretty jammed in. Although this year they did open it up more.
Yeah. And I think where we were with the wall behind us and people trying to walk past us if they were like getting out to go to the bathroom or something, trying to sit there and draw very fine detailed drawings while people were sticking their asses on my head.
Yeah.
probably would have been a little bit more difficult.
Head down, ass up.
Yeah.
So what was your how was your very first convention experience? Like one as, I guess, just as a fan, and one as being like behind the table.
My very first convention experience was probably like middle school, just diving for old books. Or
what is
something.
That? 7th or 8th? Is it?
Yeah,
seventh and eighth grade is middle school.
My middle school just fused in together with all the other ones.
Yeah, and it was like one of those like hotel shows.
Yeah,
there was like no guests, but just like looking through for back issues and everything.
Yeah,
and then actually, my first show that I exhibit at, I started putting out comics in high school, a book called Duck, and I printed it up on like the high school printing press and went up to one of the older New York Comic Cons, which just happened to be at the Javits Center, and I'd be handing out comics in line to people. I originally started trying to sell them to people in line, and
you'd pitch it to them in line, like, "Hey, listen, it's like
it's only $1. It's $1.50. Give me a comic." And the organizers yelled at me because I was just stealing money from people who were supposed to be buying comics inside. But then, at a later New York show, there was like an open table. And I just sat down behind it and threw the guy's name tag away and just pretended like I was supposed to be there. And this was freshman year in high school. I was, 16, 14?
Yeah, around that.
So there's this little punk kid sitting behind a table.
Wait, were you a punk kid when you were younger?
Well,
or were you, is that just what you're calling yourself?
A little nerd kid.
Punk nerd kid.
But it's basically like, it was like me and I was sitting next to, I don't know, it was like a show like Eric Larson would be there and like Dan Pinosi. It was like the early Image days.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there selling these like little handmade, pretty crappy comics, to be honest. And then people would come up and ask me to draw stuff in their books. And I just remember the look of disappointment in everybody's faces as I gave the book back to them. Like, they're like, oh. Cause
did you charge?
I don't remember. If I did, I didn't make very much money.
I know there's always that moment of like, oh, man, you know, when you are like, you know, like doing your services for a commission, it's that moment of like, oh, man, you got to live up to however it is, how much you're paying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like this one guy, he had a crow sketchbook, mm-hmm. and he was like, if I really like it, I get a tattoo of it. And then he was like showing me past ones in the sketchbook, and he's like, there's the sketch, and there's my tattoo. And he'd like point out probably like five or six of them. There's the sketch, and there's my tattoo. And like I'm like, wow, he actually did get the actual sketch on his body. So I was like, man, I better do a really good job, because he could possibly get this on his body. It's kind of creepy, though. But it was cool. Like, he's so into the crow that much. But yeah, like that one, I felt like, I don't know if he ever got a tattoo of what I drew. Probably not. But but it was just like that. It was like that moment of like, wow, if this is really good, it could go other places.
See, if somebody came up to me with that and said, hey, if I like this drawing, I'm going to get this tattoo to my body, I'd have the evil urge to hide something in the drawing. Yeah. Like I would draw a picture of a dick or something. And
oh,
then
like,
draw,
like
and
a little just, mermaid penis.
Yeah, I would draw something like that, and like it would be a penis, but with the crow's face on it. I'd be carefully hidden, and maybe he wouldn't notice, and he'd get it tattooed on his forehead or something, and then he'd have to go to work, and like, why do you have a goth penis on your face?
But, you know, people, I don't know, I've never actually had anybody get a tattoo of my work. Has anyone gotten a tattoo of
your
work?
Oh, actually, a very good friend of mine commissioned a full leg piece.
Oh, wow.
From me. So I drew that, and I think he wants to murder me because he says it was the most painful experience in his life. But, yeah, it's like his full calf. It's sort of like a... sort of a bunch of different characters from the book,
yeah,
and sort of like a big pinup thing going around.
Wow,
and yeah, it's really cool.
Did you get really like intricate with detail, so you know that like each line is going to be like pretty much burned into, or you know, like bloody burned into his skin?
Yeah, I mean, I went more detailed than I knew that a tattoo could be, just to give the artist a little bit more freedom, and it turned out really good. And he said the way that they arranged it, there was like a huge solid black part right on his shin bone. So he said
he's like just grinding the bone.
Yeah, basically just like pounding big solid black areas right there. And he said he never hated me more at that moment. But his name is Chris, and I'm really honored that he.
No, I think I met this guy. He was at the show at the Sondry a long time ago.
Yes, yes, he was.
Okay. Yeah, we were next to each other there, too. That was a while ago. Yeah, absolutely. That was a couple of years ago. Yeah, that was maybe 4 years ago. Three or 4 years ago.
Yeah, I forgot about that show.
I don't even know what show that was. Was that...
That was a Counterculture Fest.
Was it Counterculture?
It was the 4th.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. That was.
Yeah, because Scott White did the t-shirt design for that one. I remember that.
Yeah. And also, so Rafer is part of DC Conspiracy. Speaking of Counterculture Fest, it was a festival that we... put on. We haven't done it in a while, but the DC area comic creators, they have this coalition called DC Conspiracy, and we do also publish a newspaper called Magic Bullet, which Rafer was the first editor of, and you did the first two issues?
First three issues.
Three issues. Okay, first three issues, and then Matt Dembicki did the next two.
Correct.
So that we're up to five, and then I'm doing number six, which we're in the beginning process of.
Yes.
So how was editing Magic Bullet? And you were basically starting that whole thing.
Well, did you pitch yourself to edit it, or did it land on you?
Well, it was basically Matt. It was Matt's idea to do the paper in the first place, and there was a lot of discussion on the board about directions to go.
I didn't even know there was a board.
There's not really an official board. It's just okay. It's kind of just the powers that be that float around.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's still there. It's like an old-fashioned message board. And there was like a lot of...
I thought you meant board. I thought you meant board of directors.
Oh, no, no, no.
That's what I know about the message board, but I didn't know about the I thought you meant board of directors.
Like the five heads of state of DC conspiracy.
We don't really have that.
It's the back room, the shadow government and the conspiracy behind the conspiracy. Oh,
yeah. Everyone stay here while we go back and take a talk to the committee.
It's the, like, Illuminati.
Yeah.
That's what I assumed. Oh, no, you're part of the board.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Okay, anyway, message boards online.
So there was a lot
on the internets.
Right, there was a lot of discussion about like directions to go and like back and forth, and I didn't see a lot of actual decisions being made, and I started getting worried because I really like the idea of the newspaper, but with too many people trying to steer a ship, it tends to go in no direction. So I asked Matt if he thought it would be all right if I just took over the thing, and he agreed to it, which was cool.
Now, was this the first...
That was before the first issue even came out.
But, I mean, was this the first thing that you ever, like, was the head of, the chief editor of a book or anything like that?
Something like that, yeah, I mean...
Did you ever do something like that in high school where you're like, okay, I'm going to put my own magazine together, or...
Not to that level. I mean, in Plastic Farm, in the single issues, the first 12, I'd have backup features with other artists. But that was dealing with one artist at a time, really.
Yeah.
But this one you can deal like
not
with
like
what?
A handful of artists.
Right. And with Magic Bullet trying to raise the funds to print the thing, too, which I never got good at that, which is part of the reason why I eventually handed the paper over.
The first issue only had 500 print run.
Right, and it's you can't find it anywhere. I don't even know if I have copies left.
Oh,
I think we have like two.
Ooh.
Well, I gave one of them to Michael. How do you pronounce his last name? Auger.
I say Auger.
Auger. I gave one.
It looks like
to,
Auger, but it's Auger.
I gave one to Michael Auger.
Auger.
And so, like, I lost one, but I don't know. I think we only have like two left.
Yeah, the copies that I had left, I gave to Warren Bernard for the Library of Congress special collection. I figured that was a good enough reason to give up. Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, so you did the first one, and then so you went up to number three, right?
Correct.
Did you have any challenges in between then? Was it like a huge hit, like off the bat, and people were like slamming you, being like, I want to be in?
It was a little bit of both. The big challenge for me was trying to get advertisers and raise money enough to print the thing.
Because now you have to make another pitch, don't you? Like that's...
Yeah. So finding the artists, I actually thought was pretty easy. I'd go to enough shows, obviously, that I'd hand people a paper and say, I'm looking for artists.
Yeah.
Would you like to contribute? And people would say yes. I'd take their business card, and when I was ready to start taking comics in, I'd just email them, and then enough people would respond that we'd have a newspaper. And by the third issue, because the first issue was really good, the second issue I thought was great, then the third issue got even bigger because more and more people were turning stuff in. I think it just got easier to convince people, hey, you should be in this thing.
It's almost now you don't even have to solicitate for content.
I mean, like last week at the Annapolis Comic Con, we laid out a bunch of them copies on a table that, you know, someone already left. They left early,
right?
And then as people walked by, I'm like, hey, these are free. And then one time, or several times, people would say like, oh, that's all right, I already got them. I see them everywhere. I was like, wow, that's actually a good because
see them everywhere, man.
Before people are like, where can we find them? And then now it's like, oh yeah, I see them everywhere. I guess that's good. It's getting bigger, you know? Yeah.
And also, we funded part of the Magic Bullet last time around with Kickstarter.
Yes.
And Rafer has a Kickstarter going on right now.
I do. My Kickstarter is to print the next collection of the Plastic Farm comics, collecting issues 13 through 21. And it's just about at 100% right now. We were slightly over 100%, but one or two backers
backed out,
so it just went right back under 100%.
I didn't know you could do that in Kickstarter.
Yeah, people can do it.
What does that mean, that they backed out?
Well, you pledge money, and then at the end of the fundraiser, Kickstarter will actually take the money from your credit card. But you have time during the fundraiser itself to raise or lower your pledge any way you want.
Yeah.
And, I mean, these people, they contacted me. It was nothing that they hated my comic all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was more very understandable in this economy that they just got
Yeah.
Surprise.
So how does Kickstarter work for those people who have never heard of Kickstarter or are unfamiliar 100% with what's going on?
Kickstarter is what's known as a crowdsourcing fundraiser site where people will pledge money towards any sort of artistic project that you have. It's got different categories from music and dance to comics. And I've heard it joked that Kickstarter is pretty much the number one publisher of small press comics
in the past
3 or 4 years. But what you do is you go on Kickstarter and you find my project, which is The Plastic Farm, Seasons of Growth in the Fields of Despair.
And you can just search Plastic Farm and it'll pop up too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can go to plasticfarm.com and I got a link, probably got 10 links to this.
as well as it should, right?
And you can choose from being able to pledge from $1 up to actually $1,000 or more if you really wanted to. And it all goes towards printing the book. It's all drawn. It's all done. I actually have laid it all out. The file's ready other than adding a list of contributor names to the front index. And
see, I think that way is pretty cool because like a lot of times, I guess from my side, when we make a film, it's like that's not done.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like you guys are paying for us to do work, and hopefully it's good. But like from your side, it's already set. It's like the turnaround can be a lot quicker because I feel like there's a lot of people who put up Kickstarters and then, you know, they have a project and sometimes the project never actually like gets finished, but yours is ready to go.
Yeah, I may be biased on this, but I tend not to pledge towards the projects where it's like we've got 2 pages done in this 300-page graphic novel. Pay us some money so we can quit our jobs and draw the comics.
That's like, a little much.
I'm like, don't quit your job. This is making comics.
Yeah, it's like, well, that may never show up or I don't know. I'm just more into pledging to something that somebody's already spent all their time on free of charge or with their own money. And
like, also, you're going to get a return, I feel like, because instead of like, you know, hopes and dreams, you're already... Like, I guess, like, you know, business-wise, you're already investing in a finished product.
For me, as a contributor, I feel like you'd have to spend, enough... Well, if it's a film, there has to be, like, enough pre-production that I know it's really going to get made and that I enjoy it, but, like...
Oh, but there's never a guarantee with that.
There is never... But Kickstarter, you do have to, like, what's the word? Like, back up what you said you were going to do.
Yeah.
You can't just not make your film and be like, oh, here's... whatever, $30,000, you can't do that. You know, that's just in their rules. But, like, as far as comics goes specifically, I feel like as long as you show me, like, maybe 75%. You don't have to have everything. You know, it's good if it's already done. That's excellent. But if you at least have the promise of, like, knowing that it's going to get done after you... There's a point where you reach, like, this hurdle that you know you're going to finish the rest of it because you've already done so much for it. That's just, like... That gives you more emphasis to like actually recruit more people to like get on your team because you're like, hey, we just need to print this thing. So it's good that you already made 100%.
Yeah.
So.
Did you have to like really, because I hear stories about people almost like dedicating 100% of their time and day just to promote their Kickstarter. Did you have to hustle as hard or do you feel like you hustled like almost nonstop?
I feel like I'm annoying the living crap out of all my friends on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I mean, there's 2 weeks left in the fundraiser, and I'm sure that by the end of it, no one will be talking to me, but I'll have their money. So.
It's good that it's like that because I see a lot of times on Kickstarters that sometimes they get the money like at the last second. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can't do that. My nerves... will not take that. Plus, I have stretch goals that I would like to hit. I mean, the $2,000 that the Kickstarter is trying to raise is going just to print the book.
Yeah.
But I have other books that I'd like to put back in print, and if we can raise more money than that $2,000, then that'll allow me to put those books back into print and include them as rewards for current Kickstarter pledgers.
Did you think real hard about what the Kickstarter now I forget what the Plastic Farm Kickstarter like the incentives, what are they called when you donate a certain amount and you get something? What's
like
that?
The scale of rewards.
Yeah, did you think real hard about the rewards? Like, okay, if you give a dollar, you get something like that? Like, what was your scale on that?
A lot of the stuff I looked at, what Kickstarters that I liked, what they did, and what I thought would be successful. Like, the dollar pledges, you get your name in the book.
Yeah.
Like, you get my utmost thanks. And then...
you can have to print, like, 500 names and stuff.
Right. Which is fine. That's fine. There's room.
Yeah.
But with the rest of it, it was basically...
Did you have, like...
The books cost $20. Yeah. So that's what I set the goal as. I wasn't trying to rip anybody off or anything. I mean, it's... The book costs $20, so therefore I'm putting that as the $20 reward level. If you want this new book along with the first book, each of them is $20, that's the $40 reward level.
How high did it go again? Did it go to like $1,000 or did it go...
I have a $999 level, which is actually probably one of the coolest of the rewards.
Are you going to draw the person in the book?
No, even better. I can't draw anybody in the... The unfortunate thing of the book
it's
already
done.
Being
done.
Yeah. I'm going to white out one guy's face. And, I have a $4.99 level and a $9.99 level, or maybe it's an $8.99 level. I'd have to look. Where if somebody was to want me to draw a comic for them, I will draw 4 pages of comics for them for their story. They get that. They get all the original art, the 4 pages of original art. Eternal copyright. They can print it wherever they want.
Nice.
I can even print it in the back of a future issue of Plastic Farm. So I encourage anybody with a story in their head, whether it be 4 pages long or 8 pages long, to check that out, because
it's worth it, man.
Yeah, I think it. I mean,
I run into a lot of writers that are just like, my artist just, you know, he was gung-ho about it, and then like 2 pages into it, he just disappeared off the face of the planet.
Right. And I think it's a pretty good deal. I mean, it's, let's say, round it up. It's $500 for a 4-page story that you get the eternal copyright on and all the original artwork that you can hang up in your house, too.
How far would you take this? Are you coloring or are you just doing pen and ink on that?
My coloring style is like this old school, like early...
Like Ben Day Dot.
Yeah. So if they want coloring to look like that, I'll color it for them. If they want a different type of coloring, I can point them in a direction of somebody.
Yeah.
But I'm basically that old school guy. I'm not a fan of doing the coloring in that airbrush kind of modern style.
I don't even know if I'm a big fan of that, the modern style as well, unless they somehow make it look organic.
Right. Even like maybe like a watercolor style, but I'm not sure that I would be able to do that to their satisfaction either.
So you have this character called Morning Breath, and I needed to talk about him during the show because
I was wondering when we were getting.
How'd you hear about Morning Breath, Carolyn?
Well, I guess he's been around, but like
he gets around.
Yeah, he gets around, and. I don't know exactly when I first saw him, but I just remember I looked at him, and then I smiled, and then I just laughed, and I couldn't stop laughing, and like, every time I see him, he just makes me really happy, but I think Rafer should be the one that tells people about him.
All right. to talk about Morning Breath, I have to talk about Nightmare the Rat.
Definitely.
Nightmare the Rat is the comic that I do for the Magic Bullet newspaper,
yes.
Which is... kind of done in the style of like the maybe like a Windsor McKay kind of style, more in format than in actual execution.
Yeah.
But it's about this demonic rat that goes around and just rips people's teeth out of their mouths while they're in bed. While they're getting some Z's, and just puts them in a bag and then dances under the moonlight while tossing the teeth up in the air.
So he's kind of like the opposite of the Tooth Fairy.
He's like a tooth demon.
Tooth demon. Well, because the Tooth Fairy doesn't deliver teeth, but it takes teeth, but safely.
This takes them before you're ready for them and leaves you nothing but memories and mental scarring. But elsewhere in Hell City, which is where Nightmare the Rat lives, he has a nemesis of Morning Breath the Owl. Morning Breath the Owl is an adorable, cute little owl who, while you are getting your Z's, will sneak into your room and shit in your mouth. And basically leave you with a mouth full of feces.
And it's not just like one little turd. It's, no, it's like
it's usually
a
about,
whole mound full.
It's like 300% of
morning
breath,
weight.
Of Morning Breath's body weight.
Yeah, like when I saw that, when I first saw that image, like that you drew in Carolyn's sketchbook of the owl, and I was like, wait a minute, all that shit came out of that small little hand owl. So I think I was storing it up, man.
So like this is basically like Nightmare the Rat, you lose your teeth. Morning Breath the owl just shits in your mouth.
Yes.
Like do they, but they're both like arch nemesises.
Well,
like how does that work out?
Well, I don't I think that if so the thing is, Nightmare will go there, and if Morning Breath has already shit in somebody's mouth, he won't take the teeth because it's just a foul.
It's already been
right.
It's the calling
like,
card. Is there.
I'm not gonna touch that. But I think if Nightmare the Rat hit somebody first and took all the teeth out, uh-huh. Morning Breath might actually enjoy that, making like a softer depository.
Yeah,
well, that's like, pain. Thanks.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I got a little more room.
But that person like is double shit on.
Yeah, he's
then,
bad.
Like, they have the shit in their mouth and the teeth gone.
Oh, they're gonna.
Has that ever happened? Is that
oh
going
my
to happen?
God, that's so creepy.
That's gonna. They're definitely gonna die of some sort of dental infection at that point.
Just imagine what
that's
the owl
like
eats all day,
dude.
You know, to get that.
What does that owl eat? What does Morning Breath eat?
I don't know.
It's got to eat something like Mexican all day long or something like that.
It's got to be like, up. You know, so maybe gross. Like, you know, like those little sponge toys that when you drop them in water grow up to be giant. It must be that, and then maybe that explains why
he eats
can,
like little pellets.
Yeah, like those inflatable dinosaurs or something. I don't. You ever had those when
yeah,
you were a kid?
I know what you're talking about.
Okay, he has got to eat those. That's why he makes so much shit. Either that, or his colon's like the TARDIS or something.
So do you have any interesting stories about being behind the table at conventions? Because I know like at least what I've I don't know if this is recently, but I've always noticed that you have a pretty hardcore setup going on. You do have a wall at this point of Plastic Farm, and because how many issues of Plastic Farm are we into now?
21 issues and an original graphic novel,
and they're pretty much all out on the table too, right?
Yeah, and I'm changing that around because that is intimidating to somebody who's coming up for the first time and seeing basically a wall of books. So I'm trying to move the collections a little bit more. I've taken the first 12 issues and put them in a short box and sort of put them on the side and say, hey, if you want the original single issues, they're over here. Don't be scared of them because they're not in your face anymore. But what you really want is this big collection.
Did you ever run into veterans of the convention scene that are like, oh, you should put this book on the left side? You know, like they give you notes on like how the layout of a table should be, because that's important to when we're at conventions, right?
No, I think that is important. I think my setup is decent enough. I don't get those sorts of things, but I'm always noticing how other people set stuff up. I mean, you guys have a very nice setup. It's
do
very
we?
It's inviting.
We added Christmas lights to make it more warmer inviting. Yeah. Any way we can.
I like when we table next to Rafer. It's so inviting. And then Rafer is right next to us with all these other, like, otherworldly characters that shit in people's mouths.
That's what you say to like someone, like you're trying to like you're in a fight like in the streets or something like that, and they're all talking trash. You're like, I'm gonna shit your mouth, man. That's how bad I'm gonna do it.
He's a fun character too, because it allows me to curse at customers. Like, yeah, and I'll just shits in people's mouths. I think that actually sells some people on it. It's like, oh, this guy's not afraid to curse in public.
You got to be able to
but
curse
there is
in public
something
these days,
like
right?
appealing to it, because like if I'm attracted to it, then who knows who might be into that.
I've seen this owl. This owl is not very scary. It's a very jolly owl, I think, too.
I made it purposefully about the cutest little goddamn thing you've ever seen. With like the big giant eyes, like the little lens flares coming out of it. It's like an adorable little kitty, but an owl.
Who knows what he does?
What if he ever has like a confrontation with Owly? If they run into the same world, that'd be awesome.
Oh, well.
Like, imagine Owly having to talk to...
Well, Owly doesn't talk.
No, that's what I'm saying, but when the image or whatever they have to, like, do the word bubble in that world.
Well, even Morning Breath just speaks gibberish. It's that scribble. Yeah. That, just sort of,
that would be the best conversation ever, man.
Yeah, I think you should do a crossover with Andy Rutten's Owly.
I'll let you try to arrange that. I don't think he would appreciate me coming up and going, you know what would make your comic better? A second owl that shits in people's mouths.
He probably wouldn't.
I don't think he'd appreciate that.
You know what would really happen?
But you know what? Fan fiction.
Oh, God.
I could write something.
You know what really happened? He would go and be like, you know what? I actually had an adult version of this character that was going to do that. Because, you know, when you're making those books, you always, I feel like you got to do both ends of the spectrum. A very, like, you know, like, oh, this one's a kid friendly. And of course, it's like, well, this one will be the adult one if I ever get that chance who do dirty things, you know? But you just smush both of them into that character, which is the best part.
We do just porno versions of each other's books.
It would be really disturbing, actually.
I had discussed this with some people back a couple years ago at an old SBX of doing porno versions. I think Matt was going to do the porno version of my book, but I wanted to do the porno version of Mr. Big.
The turtle book.
Yeah, the one about pond life. Where I don't even want to talk about that. Anyway, yeah. It's so disgusting. That's what not... I wanted to do.
Yeah, I don't want to even hear about it.
You should just do that, man. That'll be the next magic bullet. That'll be the theme.
Pornography.
It'd be like the porno version of your favorite books.
No.
I feel like I guess we'd count us as like veterans of the, or you got more of you, Rafer. I think you've done 10 times more shows. Because even I heard of Rafer before we started doing comics or going into doing the conventions. So you've been doing it for like a while. Has it changed? Do you see people in and like are there for like 1 year and never seen again?
Has the scene changed?
Yeah. I think back at the shows I was doing maybe 10, 12 years ago and like the friends I had met there, and I don't see them at shows at all anymore, and I miss them. And then there's a bunch of like younger kids coming
up. Should we plug them to see people if they could research them?
Nah, I don't want to. I mean, comics is a harsh mistress sometimes, and it breaks people.
It does.
And I mean, some people that they try it out. If it doesn't work, they don't like it anymore. I don't want to put anybody on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you can usually tell the lifers. I think we're lifers. Like we're never too dumb to quit.
I feel like some people, like, the first time that they're there, they just automatically expect to get, like, a licensed movie deal.
Exactly.
Like, and like literally, like, and they might not even have a full book done.
Right.
Like, they might have, like, 12 pages and be like, all right, Hollywood, here we come.
Or those are the same, or they'll have, like, one book and they'll have spent $30,000, like, putting out a 22-issue comic of this high concept book that the only purpose is to pitch it to Hollywood or something, and when it doesn't take, now they're $30,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And well, I guess comics isn't for them.
And then they have all their comics in their garage for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Well, I still have all my comics in my garage. And I'm still doing
But you're selling
Where
it.
Else are we supposed to put them?
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah. That's true. But now you can do less of a print run compared to 10 years ago, too.
Oh, yeah.
There's also changes in that industry in that way.
Yeah, the higher quality print-on-demand stuff with the new presses, even in the past year, the print-on-demand or the digital presses are almost indistinguishable from offset, at least even with just black and white. And I work in printing, so I'm very much a print snob,
mm-hmm.
where... I could always tell the difference between digital and offset. And
oh, really? What exactly is that? So people don't know if you can share your knowledge on that.
Well, digital presses, for the most part, were basically just like copy machines on steroids.
Yeah.
It was toner-based, electrostatic printing, rather than actual offset ink, which gives it like some nice blacks and... with the print-on-demand basic, digital presses, you'd get a different kind of sheen to it. The colors would come out looking a little weird. The way it sat on the paper, it wouldn't. It wasn't actually printing like dots.
Yeah.
And to me, it looked cheap.
Yeah.
for the most part. But with advances in the printing technology, the new digital presses are actually a lot closer to the offset printing process. They're actually using digital plates, actual plates in some regards. And while it's using toner also, a lot of the newer, more advanced presses are using a style of ink in it. And they're just beautiful.
Yeah.
And even me, I studied this stuff and I look at it all the time. I couldn't tell the difference. Somebody handed me something that was printed digitally. Like, you gotta be kidding me. This looks just like offset.
So we're pretty much in a good time if people are producing their own stuff then.
Oh, absolutely. There's even with the move away from actual physical printed books
yeah.
with your tablet devices and the move towards just digital publishing, print is more inexpensive, more affordable than ever.
It is pretty crazy with color added, though. Because, like, even at Kinko's, this is the best example I can give. You can pretty much get, like, a Xerox or a black and white print for, like, around 10 cents.
Right.
And then for a color print, it's a dollar.
Right.
That's, like, that's a major price difference. So, yes. Like, 10 cents or a dollar. But color's so beautiful. But then black and white can be so beautiful, too.
I agree.
So, but I run into that cost as well, because when I was starting out, I was doing newspaper comics for the Commonwealth Times, and that way was always black and white, so that's how I got into it. And then gradually I've been adding some color, but I've never printed a color book yet.
Hmm.
And that seems very expensive.
I like the way you do color with the monotone kind of look to it recently. I like that a lot. It gives Thanks. It more what's the word I'm looking for?
Monotone?
Well, it's more like it's actually more like a duotone because it's got black and color in it. But the limited color palette is mm-hmm. fantastic. I like stuff like that.
Yeah, like
so that's the challenge of today. I feel like since everything can be, you can bring it up to that super polished level. It comes back to like, oh, you know, are you shooting photo or film? There's still that organicness yeah. that you want to try to recreate. And that's part, you know, that's why I feel like today's, since everything is so easy, you have to make those stronger creative choices just to sort of stand out.
Yeah.
And when you look around, I mean, everyone, I don't know, I feel like, I guess people, mortals who look at just stuff as like this mainstream stuff, they expect everything just to be super clean and super naturalistic, and you almost gotta like train the audience now that there's different ways of looking at books,
right.
And which I really enjoy. I mean, when did you start reading comics, Rafer? Like, were you reading back at like, even was like in the mid '80s, it was like 75 cents and stuff like that when the coloring was almost like.
Oh God, it must have been like early '80s, late '70s, early '80s. Young kid, I grew up reading comics.
Yeah, man, it was. Do you remember your first comic?
Yeah, it was. I still have it.
It's, really?
It's nice. ROM Annual Number 2.
Really?
It's got a Bill Sienkiewicz cover on it of basically ROM's crotch. It's just like ROM Space Knight is just like thrusting his. He's just standing there like in a Superman pose, but like his big giant silver crotch is just there front and center.
Was that the appeal, Rafer?
I don't know. Was
this given to you or did you buy it?
We used to take people to the airport.
Yeah.
I didn't. I was 4. My mom would shuttle people to and from the airport, help them out, and I'd go with her, and she'd buy comics for me at the airport. And she'd always tell me I could get one. So I think I got that one because it was an annual, and it was like 3 times the size of all the other comics.
Yeah.
So even then I was like, ooh, I'll get this one because it's gigantic.
It had more gorf to it.
Yes. Yes.
that was the reason right there.
Yeah, it was a very girthful comic.
It at that moment where you're like, oh, I love comics? Or did you sort of just like a couple years pass by and then did you start getting into it? Or was it at that moment where you're like, oh, man, I got to read more?
I mean, I was so young that I think I just liked it. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, there's never a time that I wasn't reading comics because it was such an early memory of getting the comic that it would be like eating food, honestly. It's like mm-hmm. there was never a time I wasn't eating something. as you can tell by looking.
I keep telling Rafer he's not that fat, but he thinks he is. I mean,
I don't be mean, but we've seen some massively fat people.
Look at this. Look at this waddle under this chin.
It's not that bad.
But you'd be surprised. There's some guys that are like super ripped and they still have that too.
It's hard to get under the chin.
Yeah.
It's a hard part to reach, you know, if you want to lose weight or something there.
Do you know when you started taking comics seriously? Like when you're like, oh, I think I should start producing my own. Did you go to art classes and stuff like that in high school or middle school?
I should have. I was stupid.
Really?
And I didn't take any formal art lessons, which was a mistake. If you have any younger aspiring comics people listening to this podcast, I'm telling you right now, take art lessons.
Go take a life drawing class.
Go
or
take
like
some
that.
Art. Yeah, don't exactly. Don't get by on what you consider to be natural talent because you actually don't have any, and you should take some lessons.
So the way you learned to draw, was it sort of like, were you emulating, or did you draw from real life? Like, what was the best process for you?
I have no best process. It was basically, I would pretend that I knew how to draw. I knew how to draw.
That's how I learned math.
You know, like when you go to AA and they tell you like how to not keep drinking is you got to fake it and then eventually you'll make it.
Yeah.
So it was basically like that. My drawing style is like Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I pretended that I knew how to draw for a long time and then eventually I figured out how to draw. And it was a long process and it was a lot of, I think, wasted years of what I think not very good artwork.
But do you think your style would be different now if you actually had that training? You know what I mean? Because sometimes those teachers try to teach their style to you.
Well, that was my thought process of why I didn't take art lessons, is I didn't want anybody messing with my style. But I think I think all it could have done is enhanced it and made me better. I still have trouble drawing hands sometimes, and I think I could have benefited from some instruction early on. But
I feel like you can. What's cool about just doing art, even though I don't like to use the word art for some reason, is the fact that you can just get better by just doing it more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, gradually, if you keep drawing hands, you'll get better.
What if you drew hands for a whole year, right? Stuff like that.
I really should. I've meant to do stuff like that just at work, just doodling and everything. But that's always the question. I'm sure you guys get it from people coming up to the table all the time, is people going like, I wish I could draw like that. And
they're like, I wish you could. How do you make comics? Or how do you make films or something like that?
Yeah, and the answer is like, I wish I had the talent to draw. And it's like, the answer is like, I don't really have any artistic talent. I've just drawn every day for the past 30 years.
Yeah.
That's how I got as good as I am now. And I'm going to keep drawing every day for the next 30 years, and I'll probably be better when I'm 60. Hope so.
You're like, I plateaued at 45.
Yeah. So the key when people say that, I'm like, well, you can draw like this. Just get off your ass and
do it.
They
just don't do it.
That really is the main part. It's about wake up in the morning and do something. You know, that's really like that's the same thing when you go to shows. It's like, hey, how do I get to have a table here? Ask.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's really the simplest way. I mean,
there's not a lottery. Well, some places that's a lottery, but just send your check in on time and you can have a table.
Yeah.
It's not that hard.
And, I mean, there were a bunch of people that sometimes I come and just hang out at the table, like, and just question some, you know, like, I guess some people find out, like, that, you know, I do photo and film, and they come up to the table and they ask me, like, everything about, like, hey, how do you. And it's really broad questions, like, how do you make a movie? So it's like, how do you make a comic? It's like, there's so many things to answer
like,
for that.
The answer is like, well, you make it. Like,
and I mean, I understand to a certain point. Everybody starts at some point. And to the uninitiated or people who aren't doing something, everything can look kind of intimidating.
Yeah.
And until you start doing it and you start figuring things out, everything's a mystery to you. I mean, if you've never printed a book, how do you know where to get something printed?
Yeah.
I've never flown a rocket ship before. I wouldn't even know where to go buy one.
Yeah.
And there's one thing that always deterred me, man.
Make it in your backyard.
Yeah. Like
potatoes and hairspray. Make a rocket ship.
When I was in high school, I was always like thrown away. I wanted to be like a comic book illustrator, and there was always that idea in my head, like, well, this other guy is better, So that sort of slowed me down. But then when I got older, I was just like, well, there's always someone better.
Right.
There's, and then also at the end of the day, I'm just like, well, how do you really measure who, if there's always someone that's better, then apparently there's going to be someone that's the best. But then how do you measure who is the best? You know, you can't really, yeah. It's all like this subjective, like being a fan of this certain style. And then people who are like the best, they might not even be doing as much work. You know what I mean? Sometimes I look at like a certain artist that I really love and I'm like, oh, they put out one book in a year. And right. Sometimes, you know, that there's some people
they're
that
aren't as productive as you think they are.
Yeah.
The thing is, you have to be happy with what you're doing right then. I mean, if what you're making is making you happy at that moment, or even then, if somebody else is looking at it and really enjoying it, then who's to say that your opinion even matters in that regard?
Yeah.
If I look at a picture I drew, I'm going to go, eh, I might not be so happy with it. But if other people are like, yeah, man, that's really awesome, then my opinion doesn't matter. If other people think it's awesome, then it's awesome.
It's awesome.
It's also, it's like the moment that you proclaim that this is done, it's sort of out of your hands, too.
Yep.
It's like, you know, boom, boom, draw for 5 minutes, it's gone. I like that idea of just like going as far as you can mentally on something and just letting it fly.
Because
I like going to the next project, too.
Yeah, and another project that Rafer is in, that Joe and I are both in, is the District Comics Anthology. So what story did you do for that, Rafer?
Oh, I drew the Harry Truman assassination attempt story, which really put me out of my normal artistic process because I used a lot of photo reference and a lot of actual going to the place, taking pictures of the buildings.
Because this book is basically like all non-fictional, all true stories of events that happened in and around Washington, D.C. area, done mostly by Washington, D.C. creators. And I think there's over 22 contributors, or somewhere around over 20 contributors.
Right.
And it was organized by Matt Dembicki. And so it's been pretty amazing to have the book published. And I've been seeing it in books, like actual bookstores.
Right.
And we went to Philly for the book signing. And in D.C. there was several book signings, or at least two book signings, one in Arlington, one in D.C.
There was a signing last week at Big Planet.
Oh, yeah. How did that go? Because we didn't get a chance to make it. Cause we already were booked for Annapolis Comic-Con.
That was pretty good. I signed a bunch of books. I mean, the District Comics signings are always interesting because you show up and there's so many people in the book and everybody's local that everybody shows up to these signings like, man, there's a lot of people at this signing. And you realize like, oh, 30 of them are in the book.
Yeah. but definitely like pick that up since Christmas is coming. So District Comics, An Unconventional History of Washington, D.C. is the official title.
I bet people have birthdays that are coming up, too.
And birthdays. Come on.
Everyone's birthday should buy a District Comic book.
And Thanksgiving's coming up.
It's a good Thanksgiving present.
Yeah.
Eat it with your turkey.
I think there's a Thanksgiving story in the book.
The key,
maybe,
is to somehow get the District Comic book somehow shown during this politics time. Somehow get it in some background.
Get like Obama or Romney to like hold it up and be like, this is a great book.
Yeah, or just have it appear somewhere. I don't even know if that's possible, but have it appear.
But Paul Ryan hates comics.
It's all right. He does?
He was bad-mouthing him the other
what?
Day.
What? He does?
Yeah, well, he used comic book as a derogatory term.
Oh.
How dare.
I know.
Just like I'm going to use politics as a derogatory term.
But his favorite band is Rage Against the Machine.
Jesus.
Tom Morello hates him.
Yeah, that was so awesome. He did that whole entire letter of how disgusted he is that this is his favorite band. And I was just like, that's why I think you're so awesome, Tom Morello.
Speaking of which, this show is actually coming out on Election Day, so we'll see what happens.
Ooh, what time? Will the election be over?
This will be released on Tuesday in the morning. Oh. So
like, as soon as it turns Tuesday.
It's an undecided right now. We don't know where the race is going.
I was
going
to say, should I record two different versions where I can congratulate each candidate as if I'm psychic? Congratulations, Barack Obama, on your second term. Or congratulations, Mitt Romney.
It could go either way. We don't know.
It could.
I think the race is pretty tight.
I just know that I can't be on Facebook for too long, but there's just so much of just like just politics happening, and I never liked that feeling.
I've been defriending people left and
right. Left and right? I do that naturally.
I mean, on the left and right also, too.
So with our District Comics story, like we didn't really want to get super political or patriotic. So, Joe, tell everyone about ours.
I mean, we did this story called Spy Teenie, which is basically a... you know, it's a late night spy romance that takes place in the silent town of Georgetown, the Silent Times, really. I thought it was cool. Because one, I like writing about spies. And also, when I decided to do this type of story, I realized there's not a lot of books to tell the truth about spies out there. So we had sort of had to like dig deep about these just certain characters. And just like you, we actually, it's the first time we had to get like real references.
Oh yeah, we went to Marden's Tavern in DC and took photographs. And then like the meal was pretty much a lot.
Oh, see, that was my mistake. I should have somehow changed it and based the assassination attempt on a bar. That would have been a much better fact-finding mission.
Well, the food was good. It was just like, I think it was, it's one of those places where you don't go all the time. It's like in a special event place.
Hmm.
But yeah, I had like, what's that Irish meal with like...
Potatoes?
Yeah, it was like potatoes. Of course, potatoes. Potatoes with that cabbage.
Corned beef.
Oh, corned beef and cabbage, yeah.
That's what I had. I don't know what Joe had.
I had a burger and fries. Well, I think we had onion rings on that day,
too. Yeah, we had onion rings.
Oh, that's traditional Irish meals.
Is it really? It should be then.
But yeah, like we took pictures and then I tried calling them about like Elizabeth Bentley, the spy, the red spy queen, and they just hung up on me.
That was the best part. Like, no one wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, no one wanted to talk about it. But yet, if you go to their bathroom, they have like a shrine to her and all these like Washington Post cutouts and printouts of whatever they've ever been mentioned.
She hung out here. Huh. Here's the story. And then they don't want to talk to us about a book that's going to be distributed. I mean, not that the place is bad.
No.
Do you think they sell the book?
We wanted them to, so we can. It's based on their place exactly. I mean, everything is right. It's there.
There's also the Georgetown Pharmacy, which isn't around anymore, but we researched the outside of that place.
Is it a Starbucks now?
I'm not sure what it is. I think it might be a clothing store. I'm not quite
juicy,
sure.
Juicy Couture, something like that.
Juicy on the butt.
So as we close the show, Rafer, tell me about the hard times of you making comics. Did you ever have any moments where you're just like, man, this sucks, I quit. And then you come back the next day, like stuff like that. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, one minute.
Still around.
I'm too dumb to die, man.
He's kicking.
Any other shows that you have coming up then that you can plug in the next minute?
Oh, December 15th.
Yep, December will be up at the... Locust Moon Fest. Is that the 15th or 16th?
Is that what it's called?
It's the 15th on Sunday.
Is it called the Locust Moon Fest?
At the Rotunda.
Yeah, it's at the Rotunda where the Philly Alternative Comic Con was and where the Zine Fest is.
I like Zine. Let's just call it Zine.
Zine. I'm mispronouncing words all the time today.
So what's your, I like Zine.
So what's your website? Plug that real quick.
It is plasticfarm.com, and you can find a bunch of different comics that I've drawn up there and links to my Kickstarter, which you should go to and pledge and give me your money, and you'll get some awesome books in return.
Yes. Thanks for being on the show today, man.
Hey,
yes,
thanks for letting me. And sorry for waking you up so early.
No. It doesn't even matter. Well, there you go, everybody. It's another show. My name is Joe.
And I'm Carolyn.
Thanks for tuning in. I don't know who's going to win, but I hope the right person wins, and I hope everyone else loses. How about that?
Sounds fair.
Sounds fair.
Hooray.
Have a good day, everyone. Everyone have a good night.
Get out the vote.
AstrayProductions.com produces this show. CurlsHappenStudio.com. Don't forget to check out CurlsHappenStudio.com/Curls. Check out Curls. See you, Carolyn.
Adios, everyone. Thanks for listening.